If so,
we're lost,
an organization of fire service personnel dedicated to upgrading firefighting techniques and safety through training. Between their manuals, ebooks, apps, curriculum, exam prep, Resource One, and more, firefighter training has never been more customizable than with IFSTA FPP products. Visit them at ifsta.org for more information. Did you know the risk of cancer does not stop at the scene of a fire? Firefighters are constantly exposed to diesel exhaust fumes and other airborne toxins that get trapped inside the station. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip through the combination of MagnaGrip exhaust removal systems and AirHawk air purification systems. Learn more at MagnaGrip.com.
Thanks for that word from our sponsors. We really appreciate you helping us get on the air, get on the internet with these programs. All of us are very grateful for you guys. Thank you very much, MagnaGrip and IFSTA.
Hi, welcome to Fire Ground Strategies and Other Stuff from the Street with Anthony Avillo and Jim Duffy on Fire Engineering Talk Radio, where firefighters come to share their knowledge, their ideas, their opinions, and most of all, have a little bit of fun at the same time. So stay tuned and enjoy the show.
Hey, 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 welcome to Fire Ground Strategies and Other Stuff from the Street on Fire Engineering Talk Radio with Anthony Avillo, and I'm Jim Duffy. This is our year-end show. This is the last show we're going to be doing before the new year. It's amazing how fast time is flying by these days. But, Chief Avillo, how are you doing this evening?
I'm good, Duff. I'm good. 20 days to Christmas. And I'm doing okay. Just sitting at home. It's a little chilly outside, but it's nice and warm in here. So I'm couldn't be better.
Good for you. What are you paying for heating oil where you are? You have gas.
We have gas. Yeah. I don't really know. I'll let you know when I get the next bill because the heat's been on.
Yeah, it's crazy. Crazy. But it's dropped quite a bit, just like gasoline is dropping a lot. I'm pretty happy about that.
Well, you know, at least we just... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
We just bought a bunch of wood for the academy. Like, you know, we use 2x4s and plywood and, you know, a bunch of different wood. And we have a contract, so they have to honor the contract at the beginning of the year. So we had, like, we bought, like it was around, like, $4,500 worth of different types of wood, you know. And the guy who took the order didn't have the contract in front of him, so he gave us the prices that they are right now. They were marked up 50%. We ordered about $4,000 worth of wood, and he gave us a price of, like, $6,400. And we were like, wait a minute, you're looking at the wrong contract. And then he looked at the contract and said, okay, I got it. But, you know, those are the prices now. Like, from the beginning of the year, the wood went up 50%.
Yep. But again, that's starting to drop a little bit too. So, you know, that looks good. In Connecticut, they've just extended the suspension of the gasoline sales tax. It was supposed to expire the 1st of December, but the state legislator has voted to extend it. I'm not sure how long that's going to be, but we haven't been paying gas tax for months, and it's a nice relief. I think it's under $3 a gallon in Connecticut right now. Not everywhere, but, you know, places like BJ's
They were supposed to do that in New Jersey. It's like a 25-cent gas tax that, of course, our, you know, big fat rodeo clown Governor Christie put on there. And they were supposed to repeal it. And I don't believe they did. So our gas prices are still up around, you know, $3.45, $3.50.
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. But it is coming down, and I'm glad to see that. I know fuel oil is coming down too, because I heat my house with fuel oil. I paid over $5 about a month ago, and now it's $380 something I can get it for. But my tanks, yeah, but my tank's full. it's going to go up when I have to fill it next time, you know. But I also burn wood. You know, I have a wood burning stove in the basement.
Oh God!
And
I don't
totally heat with it, but I augment it with it. Like this time of year, right. What I do, it's right under the den where we sit and watch TV and read and stuff. So it keeps that room warm, but the rest of the house stays cool because, you know, we're not running a furnace. And when it gets real cold, that extra heat from the wood is nice too. And we put a little kettle on it, and you know, we put cinnamon sticks in it and cloves and stuff. So the house smells really nice when you're burning the wood.
Oh, that's nice, you know? Man. That's really nice. We had a wood burning stove when I lived in Manalip, and I remember when we had the thing on in the middle of the winter, we had to open all the windows because it was so hot.
Yeah, it's a tough balance.
Yeah.
But anyway, one of the downsides of it, though, you know, I'm a firefighter and I'm preaching to people all the time to sleep with their doors closed. Well, if I got a wood stove two floors down, I got to have the bedroom doors open for the heat to get into the bedrooms. You know, so
right.
I preach it to all other people, but I sleep with my doors open. But I have smoke detectors everywhere and fire extinguishers everywhere in my house, you know. I've seen a lot of bad stuff happen over, just like you, over my career. And,
yeah, but do you let that stove burn while you go to sleep? Really?
Yep. Yep.
That's kind of
it's sealed up.
How come?
Because it keeps the house warm.
But I would think you got like an open. It's a wood burning stove with a fire in it, right? It's not
right.
Open or anything.
It's an airtight stove. There's no open. You can't see the fire. There's a little a vent on the side. It's called a damper,
right.
You know, so you open and close it to regulate the temperature. So I keep it, you know, so it's burning just around 250 degrees when I go to bed. And then in the morning, there's just coals there. And I just throw a few more on to get it going. But this time of year, I don't, you know, I just burn it for a couple hours while we sit in, you know, in the den. And let it die out. It, you know, it goes out before we go to bed this time of year. But once winter comes,
right?
Yeah, I let it burn. We did get a dusting for about an hour once, but no, it's been exceptionally warm. Just like, you know, we're not that much different than you.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah, it was the rain.
Yeah, rain for the next couple of days. But you know what?
Yeah.
I have no complaints. You know, I have wood. I have oil. There's oil in my tank. You know, there's food in my refrigerator. So, you know, today those are all good things, you know.
And you're in America.
And I am. And I'm thrilled about that, you know. I'm glad I'm not in the Ukraine, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, not
you know,
good. Not good. So
it's pretty ugly over there. But again, it is December, and you and I are going to talk about exposures in a little while, and how we deal with exposures. But I'd like to just begin with, we're firefighters, and as firefighters, this time of year is holiday season. For me, it's Christmas. Other people celebrate other things. So happy everything to everybody that's out there. But, you know, I'm going to say Merry Christmas because that works for me. But whatever faith or no faith or whatever it is that you do celebrate, do so safely. And that's what I want to talk about. I spent a lot of years working for the fire department. And the things that I think about at night sometimes, it's not the fires. It's all extrications and horrible, horrible car crashes I've been to. And we as firefighters, we like to celebrate, and we often have adult beverages, what I don't have a problem with. But what I'm going to ask all my brother and sister firefighters out there to celebrate responsibly. You know, if you're going to drink, call Uber, have somebody else drive, get home safe. The traffic accidents this past year have been horrible. Firefighters, cops are getting killed on the highways. There was just one a month ago in Cleveland on I-90, yeah. A hit and run, you know. But there's many, many more. And, you know, in Connecticut, not any specifically firefighters, but we had a tow truck driver hit on the highway and killed. But there have been more fatal accidents in Connecticut this year than probably as long as I've been alive. People are not paying attention. They're on their phones. They're in a rush. You know, they're going through stop signs because they're in a hurry. So I'm just going to ask, again, all my brother and sister firefighters to please enjoy this holiday season, but please, please, please don't drink and drive. We need you. We need you to come back home. Your family needs you, whatever it is. So please celebrate responsibly. You know, that's, you know, I enjoy my beers. Don't misunderstand. I'm not telling you, but please, please make good decisions. There's Uber now.
Yeah.
There's no reason. There's no reason Lyft or Uber, whatever service you need to use, get home safely. It's worth the $8 to get home, you know. Come get your car tomorrow. You know, so
I don't know where you're Ubering, but $8 is not, don't get you too far.
I don't take Uber too much. My wife and I have an arrangement. If we go out and we're going to have a couple of drinks, one of us drives, the other one drinks. But typically, she drives.
We're sort of the same way. You know, we kind of, you know, I'll take it tonight. You take it. Depending on who we're hanging out with, you know.
Yep. Yeah, and I understand that. So anyway, that's my public safety announcement for the evening. I think it's important. You know, I don't have to put my Class A uniform on because somebody got behind the wheel when they've been drinking. It's not worth it to me. So anyway,
no.
Tonight's subject that we're going to talk about is exposures. And how do we deal with exposures? Now, all around the country, there are many, many different things that expose. In Nebraska, it's the grass fires. You know, they spread miles an hour through districts and get farms and homes.
Mm-hmm.
In urban areas, there's inches between buildings. In suburban areas, there may be wide enough for a driveway between two wood frame houses, some with asphalt shingles. So those are the exposures many of us have to deal with. But you have a lot of experience working in the most densely populated fire district in the United States. I believe that's the case. Is that correct, Chief?
Yeah, that is correct.
So
that is correct. There
you
is,
know more about exposures with large buildings, multi-story buildings, and right on the Hudson River with plenty of wind to help spread these fires. So tell us what you dealt with and how you dealt with it in New Jersey, the center of New Jersey. And I know you have one that was Edgewater. Is that the big one that's not in your district, but just north of you guys? Is that what it was?
Yeah, Edgewater was one of the bigger ones. There was also Markel, paper company in Elmwood Park about a couple of years ago. Where, you know, the only thing that stopped that from becoming a conflagration was probably the river. You know, the Passaic River is probably, I think it's Passaic River, probably the only thing that stopped that from becoming a conflagration, you know. But there have been massive fires in New Jersey, like, throughout the years. There was one in Newark, and I think it was, like, might have been, like, 1967, or it could have been 63. It was quite a while ago, and it burned for blocks and blocks. And the only way it stopped is it hit a cemetery, and that's how they stopped it. And at that time, you know, they didn't have the same type of you know, equipment or the same type of, you know, gallonage power that we have now, you know. And your building makeup was probably a lot of, you know, older wood frame, clapboard, asphalt siding, and, you know, combustible roofs, and, you know, the whole place went, you know. I remember we lost 24 buildings in Union City one night. That was before regionalization. You know, the fire just, you know what happened? There was, you know, serious fire conditions on Bergen Line Avenue, and it was a heavy wind condition, but there were also carriage houses behind the main houses, and those carriage houses started to light off, and nobody saw them because they were all attached buildings in the front. So what appeared to be fire coming out of the back of the building was actually the carriage houses, and it wrapped around the block. And that was another, you know, really, really cold night. I remember having to chop our telesquirt out of the ice the next day. but, you know, we've certainly had our share. And, you know, I always sort of like to say that, you know, we never have a fire without at least two exposure problems in North Hudson, which, you know, to me was always make sure you have enough people, make sure you have enough water, and make sure you have enough chiefs. And then make sure you have a tactical reserve, and I think that's sort of how you put those things out. You know, it's just you just got to outlast the fire, and you have to figure out where your defendable spaces are. You know, and if you can figure that out and get ahead of them before the fire gets there, you know, you can sort of hopefully beat it back. You know, instead of chasing it, because I've seen that happen before too.
So, oh yeah, yeah. So what put this in my head to talk about this tonight? West New York and Union City had a fourth alarm and a fifth alarm fire simultaneously, which is in York Old District. So we talked earlier about the farther and further you have to call to get help. If you don't have the tactical reserves you were just speaking about, it takes longer and longer for them to get there. And you may be getting people you've never worked with before because they're coming from the next county and things like that. Tell me about how this is managed. Is this managed by a county dispatch system? Is that how it works in your area?
Well, we have fire control. Fire Control is the dispatch system for North Hudson Regional Fire. They were the dispatch system before we regionalized too, and they, you know, they covered the five cities. Originally, we were all on different frequencies, and then over time, we all became on the same frequency, which is, you know, was still prior to regionalization, and then, you know, now with regionalization, you know, obviously on the same frequencies. But they actually have now, when I was there, we didn't have multiple frequencies to operate on, you know, fire channels and command channels and dispatch channels. They do have that now, which is pretty interesting because I have some questions about how they, you know, are actually pulling that off. But they obviously are. But, you know, we've had our share over the years of some, you know, pretty big, you know, exposure problem fires, Euro houses burning. We had we were calling this one that just happened this past week, the second night of flames. Back in 2001 in December, right after 9/11, actually, we had an arson, a drug burn in Union City, and they were torching buildings. And I remember they had I got recalled in, but there was a job on Central Avenue, and it was a bunch of three-story frames. And the guys were on the roof, and they were like, you know, command from roof division, be advised, we have another fire about a block away to the west. And then about 5 minutes later, command from roof division, we have a fire now to the south about two blocks away. And it turned out they had four alarm fires going at the same time. Jersey City also had a four-alarm fire right in the north end of Jersey City, which is very close to where this occurred, in the south end of Union City. So you had five major fires going on at one time, and we had departments from everywhere. We had New York City come in that night. FDNY came in, and I got a really nice picture of them operating on Central Avenue with brand-new Ladder 3, actually. And really, really, really good picture. Again, another really cold night. They had another one a couple of years, maybe 2-3 years ago, where they had a fatal fire in Union City. This one was on, I believe, might have been Summit Avenue also, going down further. But the back of the building was asphalt siding, and it was fully involved. And it was, again, a windy night. It was cold out. And about 3 blocks away, one of the embers landed in the steeple of St. Anne's Church. And before you knew it, the whole steeple was fully involved. It collapsed into the street, you know, and, you know, again, you had task forces in from multiple counties. New York City again came in that night. I don't think they went to work. I think they just sort of stayed in the staging area. You know, that's where, honestly, you have to set up an area command, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Area command is when, you know, if I was the incident commander of, say, the Summit Avenue fire, and now all of a sudden I got this fire on Palisade Avenue and this church steeple, I have to step back now and I have to appoint an incident commander for Summit Avenue, an incident commander for Palisade Avenue, and step back and run both incidents sort of in the, you know, I'm now dealing with all of the resources now and just, you know, sort of passing the resources out to those incidents so they're not stealing from each other, you know. In the Night of Flames, first Night of Flames in 2001, that's exactly what Chief Flood did. Set up, we didn't call it an area command back then, but he actually set that up, and all of the resources coming in went to one spot and then was sort of pushed out to the individual fires that were going on.
Yeah, well, that's similar with the emergency command, you know, the emergency command center does. You know, it could be it could be set up in a dispatch someplace else that someone is. So you would call them rather than dispatch, I need another two engines, and they would locate those two engines, whether it's the next county or, you know, or
right.
they're taking up from another fire. You know, you could do that totally off site, you know, because you're running, as you call, an area command or an emergency center.
Yeah, with an EOC, right?
Yeah. You know, that could be run from there. We were very good at that during storms, like electrical storms, you know, really bad, you know, the hurricanes and things like that.
Yeah.
And blizzards where, you know, you got over 2 feet of snow. That's how that would be handled. You know, most calls are being handled with a single engine response and a plow from Public Works to get you there. One year, and I think you were with me out at Les Lucas, Nebraska, when we got home, the whole eastern seaboard was shut down. They had the National Guard there, and they were shoveling so that the fire department could get lines to houses that were on fire and to get ambulances, to get people. Unfortunately, many people died because we couldn't get ambulance to them for, you know, well over an hour.
Right.
Someone having in cardiac arrest, it just doesn't work well. But so that's when the EOC is a big, big help, you know, so you run your fire. And that's your responsibility. You call the EOC for resources, whether it's the National Guard, the snow plow, someone to bring salt to the scene because the roads are icing up, anything like that. If you have firebrands lighting off other buildings, you don't want to take an engine from your scene to go get the brand. You call the EOC,
right.
And they'll find an engine to go chase the small fire starting down the road.
Yeah,
or
somebody.
Yeah,
we did that similar stuff with the hurricane. With Sandy, I was off for a hurricane. What year was Hurricane Sandy? I was off for that. I wasn't I was still on the job, but for Hurricane Irene, I was the chief, and we set up a satellite communication system down at headquarters. And one of the things we did that we had done in storms. Going forward is we set up recon units in each battalion. So if companies were not necessarily available for certain sort of incidents, the recon units would go first. And they would say, okay, this is, you know, there's a wire down here, but it seems to be, you know, taken care of. The recon unit can stand by. And that freed up the fire units for, you know, fire duty if need be. You know, we thought it was a pretty good idea. And, you know, we've used it a couple of times. Talking about the other night, you know, I've talked to a bunch of people about the jobs and the way it all worked out is both of the cities are in the North Hudson jurisdiction. So we cover both of those cities, West New York and Union City. And the first job came in, it was a four-story ordinary apartment building on 54th and Madison in West New York, come in about 5 o'clock. And multiple rescues off the fire escapes. And the problem was the cellar, it was a fire in a cellar, heavy fire in a cellar. And the stairwells were getting choked out. So there were a lot of rescues being made, you know, from the, you know, secondary egress points. Fire started in the cellar. This one went to 5 alarms. I believe this one went to 4 alarms. And the fire wound up, you know, going up the chases and everything, getting up into the cock loft. And, you know, wound up going through the roof. One of the things that happened, though, was the what I found out was the cellar fire had, you know, in the hallways you have the, you know, the marble terrazzo flooring. And the cellar fire had burned away the wood support so badly in ordinary construction that the floor collapsed into the cellar, and a couple of guys went down into the floor. It was definitely a close call. A couple of maydays, they did get them out. But, you know, when you got those heavy fire conditions underneath these, you know, polished floors in these older, ordinary constructed buildings, you know, you got to be thinking about the potential for collapse. You know, whether these guys were thinking about that or not, I don't really know. But, you know, just looking at it from the outside as somebody who's, you know, a student of building construction, you know, that's one of those things that, you know, you have to sort of take a look at. I have never seen a terrazzo floor collapse in my career. I've seen, you know, the results of them in different places, different pictures, but I never actually witnessed one while I was on the job. But they had one the other night. And so pretty much all of North Hudson was up at that one, and they were being covered by mutual aid from Jersey City and Hoboken and Kearney and Bayonne and, you know, the other Hudson County fire departments. And then this other one about, I think it came in about 6:30. I'm not 100% sure. And this was a one-story bowstring truss. It's a Salvation Army distribution center and huge, huge fire load in there and a very old building. There was a three-story wood frame exposure on the Bravo side. There was space on the Delta side, but behind it on the Charlie side, there were more wood frame buildings. And, you know, the building was completely destroyed. And luckily, none of the walls collapsed. It just basically collapsed right into the building itself. All of the bowstring truss just collapsed straight down. But at the height of the fire, I'm watching the video that I saw it, and the fire is just roaring through the roof. And somehow that three-story wood frame apartment complex, three-story wood frame building, residential, didn't ignite. Very little damage. I know they had lines on the roof, they had lines in the building, and I had exterior lines on the exterior walls of that building. Told it was asphalt siding, which when I saw the picture, I was like, I'm not sure. And I'm going to go look tomorrow. I think it might have been asbestos siding, which, you know, sometimes we get lucky. I've had fires where we thought it was asphalt siding. It turned out it was asbestos siding, and, you know, it's asbestos doesn't burn, as everyone knows, and it makes all the difference between that and asphalt siding. So I think in that respect, while I think they did all the right things, they had all of the lines in place, what had to be done was done. I think if it was asbestos siding, I'll find out tomorrow because I'm going to go take a look there, if it was indeed a major factor in you know, not having, you know, conflagration type conditions down there in Union City. But it was, you know, it was kind of interesting because the guys on the, in the building, well, to go back to the West New York building, it was a C-shaped building. So it was two apartment buildings that were connected at the rear. There was a shaft in the center. So it looked like a big C or a U. Probably more like a U.
Yeah,
a
U.
And there was a firewall in the back, but the firewall had been penetrated over the years, and they were successful in a trench cut in the back, and they saved the It was the Delta wing, I guess, the Bravo wing. No, I'm sorry, it was the Bravo wing. The Delta wing was completely destroyed. In fact, the next day, all the floors pancaked right down into the basement while they were still doing fire watch. But they were able to save the immediate exposure by, you know, making a trench cut and, you know, doing all the things that they needed to do. So, I'm still finding more out as we go, but, you know.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question about the trench cut. Do you have any idea how long it took them to cut it? Because that looks like it was a pretty big trench cut.
I do not. I was talking to the guy who was the incident commander, and he just said they were able to do the trench cut. Listen, you have four alarms worth of guys. I'm sure they probably had three ladders up on a roof making that cut, you know?
Yeah, there you go. And that was the first fire, so you had plenty of resources right off the bat.
Yeah.
You didn't have to wait for him to come from miles away. So you had early resources, multiple truck companies, but I'm sure a lot of the truck workers or the truckies were actually doing the removals on the fire escapes, you know. So, you know, resources were really, really tapped there. And the fact that they got a trench cut in time to prevent it from traveling to the other wing, kudos to the members operating that day.
So it was really, really, really good job for them to do that. And the other thing, just funny you talk about companies coming from far away. They were companies already relocated in North Hudson. And the way North Hudson does it is there's three relocation firehouses. There is 43rd Street in Union City on Kennedy Boulevard, 60th Street in West New York, and 16th Street in Union City. Those become the relocation houses. And so they put two in one in each relocation house with the North Hudson unit. We hold the North Hudson units back, or they quickly recall companies in. They put spare rigs in service, and, you know, so that fire in the Salvation Army was pretty much handled initially by all out-of-town units from, you know, Hoboken and Jersey City and Kearney and Bayonne. I know years ago there would have been major communication issues, but I believe all of those issues have sort of been ironed out, and we generally work very well together with the mutual aid departments around by us. We all sort of work the same way with the way we set up our divisions and the way we do our accountability. It's all sort of set up the same way. So it works really, really well. If you look at the way it is, like Jersey City, very big department, you know, for us, you know, 700 guys, they don't take a lot of mutual aid in. We relocate down there a lot. But North Hudson, Bayonne, Hoboken, all that, we do bring people to the scene. We do it less than the other departments. They're obviously smaller, but we do bring people to the scene and we've been doing it for quite a while. You know, we've been regionalized for, imagine, 23 years we've been regionalized from January.
Wow.
And 24 years come January. That's another story that we could talk about the new contracts that have to come up in regard to the regionalization contract, because it was a 25-year contract, and it's just about up. So
wow. And you also have five mayors, you know,
mm-hmm.
five city councils, five
yep.
chiefs
yep.
of, you know, at least now you have only one chief of department, you know, so that helps,
yeah.
I'm sure.
Yes, and he's a new chief of department. Frank Montaigne retired, and Dave Donnarumma became the chief. Good dude. Definitely respected by all the personnel, and not a frenzied guy when it comes to like the fire ground. Pretty calm, pretty level headed. You know, so I think he obviously was on the scene. I think it was his first major fire as chief of department, and. I think he handled it well. And some of the other chiefs there that, you know, I know were working hard at that fire. Anthony Venezia is a deputy. Al Pratt is a deputy. My buddy Mark Franco was the deputy of that shift, but he was off that day, so he missed the job. But, you know, it seems to me that all the hard work that was done by all the firefighters from the entire area, Essex County sent a task force in Bergen County, I'm sure, did. So I believe Elizabeth sent one and one and a chief. I think Newark was in there, and sort of, you know, everybody else that was sort of, you know, coming from those areas from out of county, you know, it was, and that's where you kind of run into, you know, you really have to have, you know, good control. Because I like to say we have great control when we have Hudson County in. I haven't had a lot of experience with Essex County into my fires, a little bit. The night we had we lost the six buildings in the 8-alarm fire on Bergen Line Avenue. We had Newark in there and Irvington and worked very, very well together. Bergen County, mostly volunteer. Now Bergen County also, they'll muster a lot of guys, but the thing with Bergen County is we never know exactly who we're going to be getting with Bergen County because, you know, it's just, you know, their mutual aid runs differently than ours, you know. But we've had them work well. They do very well with tanker task force, not tanker task forces, setting up like water supply, you know, long water supply tasks. Now, listen, I think there's a lot more planning now that goes on than there was like, you know, 10, 15 years ago in regard to communications and turnout and things like that and, you know, response. I think it shows when you have these big fires.
Absolutely. And you know what? It even shows on little fires. You know, you say your department is involved in a 5-alarm fire somewhere. You have no resources. So the fact that people can come in and work with your callback companies, whatever, to handle those are all good things. In smaller departments or less densely populated departments, I mean, look what just happened in Mystic, Connecticut 2 weeks ago, not even 2 weeks ago, 10 days ago. They saved the Mystic Seaport Museum. Those buildings were all built in the 1700s and 1800s with huge wooden ships and buildings there. And really, the wind was blowing in the right direction, but they brought enough people in from a tremendous geographic area to work that call. They were drafting right out of the Mystic River, you know, which is salt, freshwater mixture there. You know, they did a great job. And they're all, except for, I think, three departments, they're all small volunteer departments that train together on a regular basis. That area of this state, they work so well together. Although there's still a couple of places where they don't play well together. You know, there's one city down there that the city has five separate departments. One's a career department in the center of the city, and the rest are volunteer departments. And sometimes a volunteer department on one side of the city department, the paid department, career department, they'll call the volunteer on the other side. So they'll actually have to drive through lights and sirens to accompany the area that they're not going. You know, and I don't understand those politics. People need help as quickly as possible. But for the most part down there, the way they work together is amazing. They train all the time together. And in many areas down there, it's all tanker shuttles. So that pre-planning and training, you go back – when I first started as a volunteer, different departments had different threads on their hose. There was New York Standard and New York Corp. You know, it's like the threads, you had to have an adapter for your neighboring community if they came in or you went to them. How insane is that?
We do that with Jersey City. We do that with Jersey City and Hoboken and the Lincoln Tunnel. They all have New York Corporation and we have National Standard.
Yeah.
And that's never going to change.
No, all too big departments. You know, the investment to do that is insane. And I understand that. But if you border on these communities, you better have the adapters you need.
Yeah.
You know, and know how to use them. Kits.
Yeah, we have mutual aid kits. And if you go into the Lincoln Tunnel, where the tunnel splits between New York and New Jersey, on the fittings on the standpipes in the Lincoln Tunnel are New York Corps. But on the New Jersey side, there's an adapter on them for North Hudson. And on the New York side, the adapter is in the cabinet, but it's not on the standpipes.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But at least there's a plan.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, there's a plan.
I'm going to ask you another question about all the exposure problem. Do you have in your SOPs, like an arrival order, who's going to handle the exposures, or is that called by the incident commander per incident? So do you have like the third or fourth in truck will be the exposure? Or
No, we don't. That's the discretion of the IC. The way we operate, our first engine has the attack. Our second engine gets them a supply. First ladder has the front of the building. Third engine backs down to the ladder. And then the fourth engine positions for the second water supply. The rescue buries and the second ladder stages. And if they're needed immediately, we'll position them. But the exposure issues are generally dealt with through the incident commander. Like, you know, for me, like my, you know, if I got a line or two going into the building, and again, listen, a lot of times our second line is an exposure line. It's a 2.5 coming right off the rig into the alley. You ain't gonna pass the civil service test with those type of tactics. But it's the reality of what we have, you know.
But you
it's
know what
the reality of what we
that's
do.
That's real. Go back to Riccio. Rescue exposures. It's number two on that list of priorities.
Mm-hmm.
And if you skip the exposures to get a backup line in, you now need a fifth alarm rather than, you know what, a room in contents or a beginning of a structure fire. You know, you can't ignore that. So, especially on the houses that are close together in where you have the private dwellings that are right on top of each other.
Right.
You know, if you don't get a line between the buildings, you're going to lose two at a minimum.
Well, I always looked at it like, and we don't stretch pre-connects. We stretch everything off the back. It's all static. And I was of the mindset that when I was acting chief, I said, why don't we respec our rigs to have 2.5 cross lays? We'll put 200 feet with a solid bore nozzle on each side. And because 9 times out of 10, a second line coming off that rig is an exposure line. Rather than having to pull it and break it and do all that stuff, just pull the pre-connect out. You know, I thought that was, a good idea. I don't think they've done that. In that area, it's certainly warranted, But I always thought that was, something that would have worked. But, listen, you always had to be thinking about your exposures. You always had to be thinking, where are my defendable spaces? And then the other thing is the rule of thumb for exposures. And this we got out of the civil service exam, the rule of 15. If the building exposures are 15 feet or closer, or the wind condition is 15 miles per hour or more, you have to address the exposure. You have to prepare to fight a fire there, meaning you got to evacuate it. You got to get a water supply. You got to get a line in between the buildings. If it's an attached building, you got to be checking the shafts. You got to be going to the top floor. But again, now that's a very sort of fluid type of number, because as the fire gets bigger and or the wind conditions get worse, that number gets bigger. There are places you've seen buildings that might ignite 100 feet away, on when you have a huge monster fire in a factory or a big townhouse complex, or you have a severe wind condition, when the church, that church was like 3 blocks away, So your rule of thumb for exposure to 15 foot is a good rule of thumb starting out, but then you have to consider fire conditions and wind conditions.
Absolutely. What they did in Wallingford right after I left, actually just before I left, they put on the tailboards of all the engines, they're called blitz fire. They're like a small monitor, 500 gallons a minute, with setup where you can actually pretty much drop it in the street. It's attached to a static 2.5-inch line, though.
Mm-hmm.
So you would still have to break and hook it to the pump, but you can grab this mini deck gun or monitor and drop it in that alley and with very little effort, you can anchor it where you don't need anybody to really monitor it, but you'd leave one person there, and you can handle those. So it's not a pre-connect, but that nozzle is pre-connected to a dead load. So, you know, you can stretch it, like say if it's houses and it's, you know, 20-foot driveway to the alley between the wood frame dwellings, you drop it right there, you break it at 200 feet, hook it into a 2.5-inch discharge and go, you know, and you can leave one guy there running it. And it works. You know, I remember the chief at the time didn't like the idea, you know, I'll just pull a 2.5, just, but it's much more manpower intensive to put a 2.5.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, that little Bliss Fire is a great little piece of equipment, man.
It really is. I remember the first time I used it.
Go ahead.
Well, anyway, the first time we used it, it was a car in a garage to a split level house. So, and it was already into the house. So the first line dropped the monitor into the garage and left it unmanned into the garage. And then, 1.75 inches in the front door of the house to get control of the interior fire spread problem. So it freed up people. One of the engines was down a man because someone rode in with the ambulance for a critical patient. So the engine showed up with two people on it, you know, so your options are limited. So, but it's a great little tool.
I saw it. One of the mutual aid companies must have pulled it the other night down at the Salvation Army. They had cut one of the gates and they put the Blitz Fire right in the gate, like right where the gate was, and put the Blitz Fire and they just charged it. So I thought that was, you know, a pretty good tactic, you know, considering it was bowstring truss, I'm not so sure I would have let them get that close, but,
drop it and get away.
Know, but,
thing about, I want to say, because, you know, a lot of people listen to us, Blitzfire is a brand name, but there are several different manufacturers that manufacture a similar device. So I'm not saying, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm saying this is the product you have to get. You know, there's Elkhart, there's Task Force, everybody has their own version of it. So I'm not, you know, saying endorsing the Blitzfire itself, but that's what we call it, you know. So, you know, it's like a Bilco door. All those doors aren't made by Bilco anymore, but we still call them Bilco doors. So just as a disclaimer for sponsors and stuff that, you know, but it's a great tool. And, you know, again, it's just like anything new. People are resistant to it. But once you've seen it in operation, you know, if you're using it correctly, you know, you don't drop that in the front door of a house because you don't want to go in, you know. But it's a great tool, and it's almost a pre-connect.
An untenable seller.
Yeah. I one time was in A&P, and we put a Breslin distributor into the basement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a great, great, great advantage. You know, it was a big, it was probably 80 feet deep and 200 feet wide. It was an A&P, you know, grocery store. And they had the deck in the front where the window display was and just dropped it right in there from the outside until, you know, and they actually used high expansion foam eventually. I only saw that used once.
Yeah, me too. Once, no, maybe twice. Maybe twice I've seen that. But, you know, you know, it's not something you do every day, but it's in your arsenal, you know, in your arsenal. I got to tell you, one of the best tools that we ever had for the exposure problems were the telesquirts. That 50-foot telesquirt, man, we would back down in as the third dew engine. We'd come in behind the ladder, we'd leave room for the ground ladders, and then we'd supply it. And if we had a, you know, exposure on, you know, one of the sides of the building, you know, right away that telesquirt going right into operation and just start washing the walls in the alley. You know, it could also hit heavy fire if it had to, but it was mostly being used as an exposure protection device. You know, great. You know, Ron Jeffers used to call the telesquirt the urban the urban battleground piece or something like that. I'm trying to remember what he called it. perfect for the urban battleground. I don't remember the exact term he used. It's in my book, actually. It's in one of the pictures. And it's basically a quote from Ron Jeffers, who, you know, took some great, great pictures of those fires, by the way.
I'm glad he's still out taking pictures of fires. You know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. He was a police sergeant who just, you know, he was a firefighter on the inside.
Yep. Yeah, well, like, what do they say? What do firefighters and cops have in common?
They all want to be firefighters.
That's correct.
Howard, that's the answer.
Correct. That's the answer.
Holy shit. Yeah, you know what's interesting now? That Mystic Seaport fire?
Yep.
When I saw that, I thought that was like video from a long time ago. I didn't know that fire was just this week.
Yeah, it was I think 10 days ago.
Wow. So what departments are up there? Like Nick Papa, New Britain, that's not up there, right? Or New London?
No,
whatever he's
no. They're like so far apart. You know.
Okay. What departments are near there? Like what
nope.
Bigger departments are in that area? Nothing, huh?
Let's see. New London is
that
probably
bridge there.
Yeah, New London is probably
that,
the Pearl Harbor
that,
Memorial
that,
Bridge, maybe.
Is that I-91?
95.
That is 95. Okay.
I-95.
Okay, yeah.
So
the Pearl Harbor
the
Bridge.
Closest significant size department would be New London. The sub base has a department. Groton has a department. Now, in Mystic itself,
mm-hmm.
there is Stonington, Old Mystic, Mystic, then there's Pequannock Bridge. What else is over there? Groton. They're all very, very small departments.
Right.
Waterford. They have a great mutual aid, and they have for, I'm going to say, 25 or more years, they've had a great mutual aid set up. They work really well together. And
good.
It's something they should be proud of. And I'm telling you, that fire was going on arrival. I mean, that building, they had boats in it, propane tanks in it. And then it just spread to the wood frame building next to it. I mean, I don't know if you saw any of the videos. But,
I did see video. That's what. But I thought it was, I thought it was a long time ago that you know, people put fire of the day or something. That's what I thought it was. I thought it was something that happened a long time ago.
Well, the thing was, when I first saw it, I thought it was the Mystic Village, the museum and see, because it's,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
what it looked like, those old wood frame buildings. But the wind direction was correct, and their, exposure protection, they did a great job. They had a couple of little fireboats there. You know, they don't have the big fireboats, but they have, you know, good fireboats, 2,000 gallons a minute plus. And, they
get water on the fire, right?
Yep. And nobody was hurt. No civilians, no firefighters. I think one person twisted their ankle. And, you know, that may have been it. And they were there. Oof. You know, and again, the wind blowing
yeah,
right
there a long
direction.
Time, right?
Yep. So,
wow.
Again, exposures. I mean, talk about a valuable exposure, the Mystic Seaport. That's a national treasure. You know, the Amistad was there. The Morgan was repaired there. There's so much going on there. And, old wood frame, literally old wood frame buildings, hundreds of years old wood. And, they don't put any, they leave them the way they are. I don't know what the fire protection system is. I'm sure some areas have some fire protection. But, to not lose that is a good, and it was just, the fire was just south of that. So, again, exposures, they're important. Simple thing when you're talking about, defensive, it's write off something that's already lost, future exposures are there now. You have to set up to prepare for all of that. And you know that better than I do because of where you spent your career. You know, my biggest problem with exposures was, you know, the three-story wood frame balloon-constructed buildings that were built feet from each other. You know, there was not even driveways in some of them. You know, they, you know, if you farted, the guy next door said, "Hey," you know, if you sneeze, they say, "God bless you."
Oh,
that's how close.
Yeah, but the other
that's
thing
how close
you guys
were.
Got the soffits, right?
Oh yeah.
You know, if you get fire up, you know, exposing those soffits there and melt that soffit away, and like all of a sudden now you got fire in the attic at exposure.
Yep, and some of them have what they call rafter tails. The rafters actually extend beyond the vertical wall, so the rafter will stick out a foot or so, and that's where the soffit is. And they're open, you know, pretty much very quickly when exposed to fire. But you also have the interior fire spread with the balloon construction. You know, it's you know, they're all built turn of the century, 1890s, some maybe 1880s, up to the 1920s. They built those buildings, and you know, the exposures. You know, so it's something we smaller departments tend to forget about is the exposure. Oh, you got a fire in this house. You know, you forget. You know, it's blowing out a side window and it's 6 feet away or 8 feet away. And they have the wooden clapboards on the side. There's a good chance that you're going to get fire extension. And by the time you notice it, you know, it may be too late. Now you got to put 2 3/4 lines into that building because you didn't address
wall siding.
Yeah, we don't have too much of that. Some of the downtown area has it, but where I was born in Queens, man, there's still a ton of that stuff. Because the stuff doesn't
wear
out. Yeah, we
got it all over the place.
Yeah, that stuff is crazy. But it never leaked, you know, and it's frozen gasoline. And it, you know, you just thaw it out and light it off.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the idea with that is that's where, you know, you got it. Like, we've had fires where, you know, they immediately put a deck gun on that wall, you know, to knock that fire down, protect the exposure. You know, like, those are the ones that, you know, you need. It usually knocks down pretty quick, but, you know.
Yeah, it
does. You got to have enough water. You got to have enough water, and if you don't have enough water, you ain't knocking it down.
Let
you know,
me
and
ask
then
you
it creates
question.
Another problem of radiant heat.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Let me ask you a question. When you first got into the fire service, did they still have water curtains?
We never had water curtain nozzles. I had heard of them, but I got to be quite honest with you. I don't think I ever saw one except, say, like at a fire academy.
Yep.
I don't think.
We carried them, but I never saw one used because they knew better by the time I got into the fire service that they're useless. But they were there, you know. They were carried on the rigs. I don't know when they stopped carrying them.
We had some, like, crazy equipment when I first got on the job. I remember, you know, they had, like, the Atlas Crash Axe was, like, one of these things they had, this big, like, monster axe and, you know, the scaling ladders, I mean, the Pompier ladders, right?
Yep.
I mean, like, you know, just crazy stuff, you know, equipment that you had that, you know, they just used for years, you know, and it worked. It helped, you know?
Yeah, you know. Ground ladders can only go so far. The Pompier ladders were, they served their purpose. I'm glad I never had to use one.
Yeah, no, I never used one either. I actually never even climbed one.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, a lot of guys did. I remember seeing, I don't know if it was New York or Chicago or something, and they, you know, there were guys on every floor. It might have been probably New York Fire Academy. Guys on every floor on a Pompier ladder, hanging off the ladder.
Yep. Yeah, crazy stuff. Remember the nets? I mean, I know you don't remember personally, but they carried.
No, we had a net. We did have a net. Now I'm
we carried them, but you never used it, though.
No, I never used it. Never jumped in it. But we did have
it. I jumped in one. Now that you mentioned that, I did jump in one my first couple of years because they carried it on a truck. Never used it, but it was there. And they took it out and, you know, they wanted to get the new guys to jump into it. Oh, my God.
No, that's good. Yeah. The things we did, right?
Yep, but again.
Now you look at some of the equipment that, you know, was sort of outdated for years and, you know, there's always still uses for it. Like, you know, like the Bresnan distributor, you know, like, you know, they're using it now to drop it down a couple of floors into a wind-driven high-rise fire and let the wind push it in, and then it pushes out, then the wind pushes it in again, and it's just flowing water all over the place. I mean, you know, what a brilliant idea.
Yeah, I've heard that people use them in attic fires.
Yeah. We've done it with cockloft.
Yeah.
We did it with cockloffs. We used them in cockloffs. We just cut an inspection hole and dropped the distributor in there. But, you know, I was talking like with Jerry Tracy and those guys, and they were talking about, you know, you drop it down in front of the window in the high rise and the wind blows it right into the apartment.
Wow.
It actually might be even, you know, more effective than a high rise curtain. You know, because it's not going to fire down. It's just you're getting water on it instead of, you know, stopping the wind. You're getting water on it. It's really interesting stuff.
Yep, there's a lot of stuff out there, you know, and especially on the extrication side of it, the rescue side of it, you know, rescue jacks, airbags. We've come a long, long way, but this is so far from exposure protection. But
yeah, we have.
I think, you know, personally, back to the exposure, I think, you know, we have to keep it, especially small departments, you got to keep those exposures in mind. Unless it's already exposed on arrival and you're starting to see some, you know, some flame impingement on arrival, of course you're going to deal with it. But sometimes, you know, you've set up your interior tack, you're in there working, and you're not seeing what's going on the sides. And that's one of the other reasons I like to have the incident commander standing out in front of the building and keeping an eye on what's going on. Because if you're standing in front of the building, the A side of the building, you can almost, with only walking a few feet, you can see three sides of the building. You can get information at least from three sides of the building. So you can see, you know, in bigger departments when they have people that they can put in all these intermediate levels, maybe not necessary, but where I worked and where you worked, I think the incident commander needs to be standing in front of the building, you know.
I think he needs to be standing in front of the building at all times. That's just me.
Yep. No, I agree. But again, you need to see what's going on. Not that you're micromanaging by standing in the front, but you get a really good view and you can see, you know, when the steam conversion in a room, you got fire rolling out the window, then all of a sudden, poof, now you got smoke coming out, then you got white steam coming out. All that is information that you need, or that exposure going. You know, you're starting to see...
Right.
That the siding is starting to off gas, it's starting to steam and smoke. Hey, we need to get a line over there quickly.
So I just get a message here on the phone. That's where it's nice to have 4 or 5 man crews in the engine. You could stretch an interior line and an exposure line. You know who just sent me that?
Okay. Why, do they have 4 men?
At least we got one guy listening.
Yeah. Hello, Mike. How you doing?
How you doing?
Hey,
all right, so we're getting ready to sign off here soon, but we will have to have Mike Master on the show. He is as colorful a character as it gets.
Tell him next time. And all these people, you know, all these retired people still being into the game. I love it, you know. You know, Aaron retired.
Aaron Heller.
I know he did. I think that's... good for him, you know. I asked him if he was still going to continue teaching, And he said, absolutely. You know, I said, well, there, you're still making a difference. You're going to miss it.
Yeah, exactly. I thought he was like 100 years on a job, Aaron, man, but he's not.
No, he's younger than me. But I guess
everybody's
everybody is
younger than you.
But anyway, Mike, we're up in January. I don't know what date yet, but you should join us. That would be awesome.
Yeah, we'll reach out to you, man. We'll reach out to you, brother, because we would love to have you on here.
That would be so much fun.
I wish I knew you were listening from the beginning. We would have pulled you in right now.
Oh, we can still do it. Now we don't have enough time.
No, I got something I got to do upstairs, so that's why I said we got to sign off in a few minutes.
We should bring somebody from the West Coast, and you know who I mean. We could discuss that whole thing.
Exactly. Like I said, Vince Lombardi never coached the game from the locker room.
Well, he's probably thrown out of a couple of games where he had to, even though he wasn't officially coaching the game.
That's why I didn't say Billy Martin.
Yep. Hey, speaking of football, next Saturday, I believe it's the Army-Navy game. It's my favorite game of the year.
Nice.
I'm a Navy guy, but you know what? It's just such a great game. You know, I just love
the whole thing,
the setup, the halftime, the marching in, and then singing the other teams. So, you know, all of that I absolutely love.
It's all tradition, man.
Oh, it
not
is
much
tradition.
Different than the fire department. It's all tradition.
But anyway,
good, so.
So all those out there listening, you know, I gave a little PSA at the beginning about, you know, driving and drinking, you know, over the holiday season. We want all you guys to continue to help people and be part of the service. You know, brothers and sisters out there, take care of yourselves. Call Uber. Have fun. Enjoy your Christmas parties. I'm sure you all have shift and department Christmas parties or holiday parties, those people who don't celebrate Christmas. But it's a great time of year. Take care of each other. Reach out to your family, your friends, and, you know, stay safe. And see you next year.
Yeah, Merry Christmas to everybody, and have a great new year and a healthy new year, and stay safe out there. Stuff,
and
Merry Christmas to you too, brother. Love you.
Yeah, Merry Christmas. Love you too. And we'll talk before Christmas. I can be sure of that. Until we meet again, stay safe and don't forget to buy American when you have a chance.
Thanks, man. Peace out.
Adios.
All right.